Hello and Namaste from India. This is Aditi Sharma, Chief Research Officer of ICIL, and I warmly welcome all of the viewers to the second panel of Indocon 2021. In this panel, we'll be discussing a very important and controversial topic of this decade, that is role of AI hype in the world of information warfare. So with me, I have five very special people from across the globe who will be helping you to understand the nuances of the topic. With us, we have Dr. Jeffrey Funk, who is a technology consultant, Mr. Bogdan Grigorescu, who is the Vice President of AI Generally and Head of Quality Assurance at Finity. We also have Ms. Jackie Hugh, who is a board member at For Humanity and senior advisor to the UK government. Then we have Dr. Richard Self, senior lecturer in the Governance of Advanced and Emerging Technologies at the University of Derby. And finally, we have Ms. Savita Jagdeesan, senior partner at Fisher & Company. Apart from all these dignitaries, we will also have special remarks by Mr. Ryan Carrier, who is executive director at For Humanity. So let's begin the discussion then. As you all know, that the topic of this panel is the role of AI hype in the world of information warfare. Presently, AI has become a buzzword in the society, and that's why I referred to the word controversial when I first mentioned the topic of this panel. In every country like India, many people do not understand the basic feature of simplest of technologies, but yet they want to get associated with the term intelligence. What I mean to say is students who do not even have a base in computer science want to learn AI, or job seekers want job that will allow them to use AI. Companies want to use AI in their products. Startups are using AI as their core technology for their platform because they know that investors are interested in AI. Companies hire AI experts even before they plan how they should use AI in their products. And any technology that advances at such an aggressive pace would be difficult for anyone to ignore. Obviously, it is important for us to stay up to date with these technologies, but learning or implementing something before we understand how it will help us is a very bad idea. Even the news headlines flash quotes from people like Elon Musk, who warns us saying that super intelligent AI is much smarter than we are, and represent the single biggest existential crisis that we face today. But the question remains, is it worse than the problems like climate change or nuclear weapon or pandemic that we just had? It's just people who have invested in AI, they are trying to promote these technologies. And they are promoted through fear-mongering rather than explaining it to the people. What are its uses, its policies, or how it works? Experts, on the other hand, are pushing back against the hype and pointing out that many alleged advances in AI are based on film's evidences. So what is it then? Is it the demand of this hour that carries these hype? Or are these just hypes, or do it contain some reality? This is what we aim to discuss in this panel today. But many people like me know what AI hype is, but they do not understand it. They only know what we read and what we hear in the news. However, with us, we have a panel of experts who can explain to us what this hype is or how does it work. But I specifically like to request Mr. Bogdan to explain to us what AI hype is in very simple words in 2 minutes so that we can begin this discussion understanding what we are discussing today. Sir.
Hi everybody. Very good to meet you all. And thanks for the audience to allocate time on a Sunday to listen to this important debate, most important debate. We can summarize the AI hype in one word, a lie. It has become a lie. The hype is not a lie by definition, but the AI hype has become essentially absurd. Extreme levels of borderline obscene. It has become a lie. That's what it is. It's a lie. And it's a different type of lie. It's not a lie that necessarily doesn't tell the truth. It's a lie by omission most of the time. because it only looks and exacerbates the positives, which are positives are real for sure, but so are the negatives. And if you look at the hype itself, it's only about the positives. Big positives, only positives. It's almost like a horoscope. You look at the horoscope, everything is great and positive. There's zero negatives. Every single sign in the sky is tremendously good. That's the same with the AI hype. So that's lie by omission. The problem with that is it creates tremendous societal issues for many decades to come, because it's automated. It's automated at grand scale. Before, we have the hype at, say, 3D TVs, a gimmick, of course. But it didn't create any societal issues. It just milk you or a tidy amount of money for no real benefit, but that's about it. Well, the AI hype doesn't do that. It's essentially burying science through warp business models that are all about quantity, and they don't really take into account, unless forced by law, the human dimension. It strives to automate decision making, and we've seen so many cases. Uber drivers, robo fired with no explanation. That's essentially a huge. I mean, it's just illegal, is it? You cannot be fired without being given an explanation. In most countries in the world, well, it happened. More recently, 1.6 million National Health Service patients in UK filed a mass lawsuit against DeepMind because their medical records, the so-called SPII data, super PII data, medical records have been shared recklessly with, well, unknown parties, frankly, to the patient. So the data subject did not know what of the data has been shared, how and with whom and for what purpose. And that's a mass lawsuit just launched last month. 1.6 million people. And, you know, this is by design. So that's the AI hype in one word. It's a big lie, very dangerous lie that essentially puts society at risk.
Thank you so much, sir. So before we start the discussion with other panelists, first, I'd like you all to hear special remarks by Mr. Ryan Carrier on this topic.
So I have Ryan Carrier, the Executive Director of For Humanity from the United States. So Ryan, thank you so much for giving your special remarks on the very panel itself. So we would be very interested to know your thoughts on AI hype and how it contributes to information warfare from a legal perspective and from a compliance perspective.
And thank you for having me. I'm very sorry I can't be live, but it's my honor to be at the Indian Conference for Artificial Intelligence and Law. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for allowing me to make these recorded remarks. I appreciate it. I started For Humanity in 2016, really as a reaction to artificial intelligence hype. What I saw concerned me. Now, I had a 25-year finance career. Now, we used artificial intelligence to manage money in my last efforts. I was running my own hedge fund at the time. So we used artificial intelligence, but as I was stepping out of that role, as I was winding up that hedge fund, one of the key things that I saw was hype. I saw a lot of artificial intelligence, autonomous system usage and development, and this general belief that it was going to solve all the problems. AI would solve all the problems. Autonomous systems would solve all the problems. And you know what? Maybe it will. Maybe it will. I hope it will. We have a lot of problems, a lot of things to work through. But the thing that I was concerned about and I reacted against was those developing these systems had an insufficient amount of risk management. And in fact, they were very poor at managing downside risks. And so I felt compelled to do something about it. My boys were 4 and 6 years old, and I extrapolated out the future that I saw as a result of kind of AI hype and overselling, and more importantly, a failure to manage risks. And I extrapolated that out into their future. And I don't mind sharing, I got scared enough that I felt compelled to do something about it. And so I started For Humanity. For Humanity, very simply, the mission is simple. It's to examine and analyze downside risk associated with AI and autonomous systems, and where possible to engage in a way to mitigate that risk. And if we can mitigate risks to AI and autonomous systems, if we can manage this hype, then what we can do is we can get a better result from all of these tools for humanity. And thus this huge, overly ambitious, exciting name for our nonprofit, where we focus on trying to build risk mitigations. And we've looked at things like future of work and technological unemployment, and rights and freedoms in the fourth industrial revolution, data, should we own our own data? But the thing that we settled on, the thing that we focus on at For Humanity right now, is developing and bringing independent audit of AI systems, a primary tool for building trust in AI and autonomous systems to help mitigate these risks all around, to help manage this hype into a systematic, accountable governance oversight structure where the design is human-centric at the center of development, but also that the outputs are very much in the interests of humanity. And so this is kind of our primary mechanism for managing this hype. The idea is to create a whole set of rules, laws, guidelines, best practices. These are all out there, but to bring them into a manner, into a way that they can be achieved, compliance or non-compliance, where a third party independent body, an auditor, can come into the space and identify on behalf of humanity, on behalf of the public, as a proxy for the public, to identify that these compliance items have been met and achieved. And all of these audit rules, most of the law that's crafted, most of best practices and guidelines benefit humans. And so when we know that they've been implemented, when we know that they've been met, then we know that we are getting a better result from these systems. And we don't have to have massive transparency. We don't have to see source code. What we have to see is that these systems are built with transparency, with disclosure, with around explanations about how the systems work. And so that when we have these in place, then we can understand the systems. Then we have the information as people where we can make informed decisions, not have these things put upon us in a way that makes it difficult to know if there's value in these systems, if we even want to expose our data, ourselves, our lives to these systems. And so in this process, with disclosure, with transparency, with independent oversight and governance, we can know that we get a system that will work for us instead of against us. Now, many of the systems that are out there are built by very small design and development teams with insufficient diverse inputs and multi-stakeholder feedback, ensuring that we see a wide range of risks that can be embedded in these systems. And one of the core problems of this is data, how data is used. I'll give you an example. Facial recognition technology, used extremely widely, law enforcement, borders and migration, just even monitoring public spaces, right? And these systems were sold really around the world to many, many different operators. And we were told that it was with a 95 or better percent efficacy. Here's the problem. When you take an average, when you look at efficacy, and when you look at a white man, me, you know, as an example, right? And I'm a large part of these databases, meaning white middle-aged man, right? The system gets trained and understands white middle-aged man, understands me just fine. What it fails to do and what the systems failed to take account of is when they have insufficient or even bad data for others, especially minority groups, especially those who are likely to be adversely impacted by these systems. And so whilst the average facial recognition validity was very high, pretty accurate, when you look under the hood, when you look at the details of the data was insufficient for many minority groups, protected category groups, and the intersection of those protected categories. For example, the validity, the accuracy for Black or African origin women, that intersection of protected categories, was significantly lower than 95%. And thus the outputs, the outcomes of a facial recognition technology on these protected category groups was significantly lower, making the whole system much less effective than that 95 or higher percent, sort of marketed and demonstrated system. And these are the ways, these are the concerns that we have to all care about to make sure that the systems that we allow to be used, the systems that we allow to be in our lives and making decisions for us and involved in the processes that we have, that they're built correctly. And a big part of building them correctly is building them with robust data that impacts fairly across all protected categories for all people groups who might be impacted. And a huge part of that process is to consider the input, the risk assessment from diverse inputs and multi-stakeholder feedback. Most design and development teams building AIs and autonomous systems are very narrow. They're focused, and they might be even diverse in an ethnicity sort of sense, right? You might have 5 or 6 people from 5 or 6 different backgrounds, but if they all went to MIT or if they all went to Stanford, what you don't have is diversity of thought. You don't have diversity of lived experience. And these background kinds of information are just as important as your ethnicity or your gender or your age when it comes to protected categories and building in diverse inputs and multi-stakeholder feedback. And so this is the kind of diversity that For Humanity demands in our audit infrastructure as we're trying to build out best practices and requiring entities, and they can be corporations building AIs and autonomous systems, or governments. We are speaking to governments around the world who are beginning to say, I do want to be a good public servant. I do want to make sure the systems that we're using are fair. Will you help us? Can you help us to build out this sort of auditable criteria and this transparency in governance, accountability and oversight that we can bring through our process? And so just to wrap up in last couple of minutes here in terms of artificial intelligence hype, one of the things I want to be clear about is that AI, autonomous systems, and the advancement of technology may over time achieve a lot of the goals that we hope. It may overcome a lot of problems. It may even achieve the level of hype that exists in the marketplace today. But it certainly isn't there today. And it's because it's not built on a robust foundation that's human-centric, that's built on a foundation of ethics. What you have to realize about these systems is that they are not technology like a calculator, right? The calculator doesn't project any ethics. It doesn't make any decisions for us. What it does is it produces the output of equations, right? When we deal with artificial intelligence and autonomous systems that interact with us, where we are a part of the system and a part of the data that feeds through, and it's beginning to reach conclusions, like a recommendation system, right? A recommendation system aims to try to figure out what is it that I might be interested in buying. It's presupposing decisions for me. And so it is a socio-technological system.
Okay, so I suppose there might be some issues. Irrespective of that, let's just then proceed with the panel. For Mr. Ryan has given us amazing accumulants of hype, so we can start our discussion on that note. Starting with the questions, my first question would be to Dr. Funk. Who, sir, my question to you would be, I read your book titled What's Behind Technology Hype, and I found a lot of interesting points in those in that work. So my question to you would be, do you think that the hypes create any gaps in the marketing or component of AI? And if they do create these gaps, do you think that the gaps are irrecoverable? So you are, I suppose, mute. Please unmute yourself. No, sir, we cannot hear you yet. So, if you can remove the earphones, probably then it can work because we cannot hear you yet. No, sir. We not hear you yet, sir. So I'll just ask. Meanwhile, you kind of set the problem. I can ask the same question to Dr. Richard. So would you like to answer this question, that how these gaps created by hypes are recoverable or irrecoverable?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure that it's irrecoverable gaps. It's more that there is just so much peer pressure around at the sort of senior levels of many, many companies that they've got to have AI in their product set or in their services they're giving to their customers, to their users. I remember one occasion a few years ago talking to a colleague from a telecoms company in Scandinavia, and the sponsor had wanted a gadget to do stuff to make life easier for his staff, but it had to have AI. And when this colleague looked at the solution, a traditional algorithmic system would be much more sensible, but he still had to keep the term AI in the title as far as the sponsor was concerned. So we've got unreasonable expectations all over the place. We've also got a lot of misunderstanding of when these AI systems actually work. And we know that they don't work in an enormous range of situations. We're beginning to see some small evidence that the areas that AI seems to be working reasonably well, and I'm talking here in the European Union's AI Act definition, which is traditional learning systems, as we know them now, traditional expert systems from the 1970s, 1980s, but also, and here's the real kicker, they also include almost all forms of modern analytics techniques, including regression analysis, Bayesian inferences, recommender engines, and so on. So we've got an incredibly wide range now of that definition. And what we're seeing is that if we are wanting to get good results, we need to have causal theories available to us. In other words, we know these are the parameters we can actually measure, almost like putting a voltmeter onto something. We can measure the right parameters which have causal relationships with the thing we're trying to control. And we're beginning to see that those do work, for example, in aerospace, engine condition monitoring, equipment condition monitoring, predictive analytics, and so on. We're seeing it working in, as far as we can tell at the moment, in terms of things like protein folding. Again, this is very much driven by physics and engineering. Where we're finding it very, very difficult to see good results or effective results, and as that introduction pointed out about the problem of lack of diversity and the problems of bias and so on, when we start getting into what we could call social sciences or soft sciences, whether it's business management or medical treatment, then we begin to see a little bit of a difficulty because we're not measuring the directly affected parameters. We're measuring proxies, or we are using kind of, I would hardly call them theories, hypotheses perhaps. And we saw that in a big debate on LinkedIn over the last week or so about personality tests like MBTI and so on. And how can we expect an analytic system to be able to discover the truth when there are 20 different groups of people around the world with 20 different theories or hypotheses about what makes a leader? And the way they're measuring is not direct measurement. It's very, very indirect. What is your opinion of blah, 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 rated on a scale of 1 to 5? How do I know your 3 is the same as my 3? And how do I know that that question has any direct relationship whatsoever to the leadership qualities? And so that's another big area. And that if you look at the introduction to the AIA, the first paragraph, it says AI is a fantastic thing. It will, a bit like we saw from Ryan just now, you know, it may well work. And they're saying AI will be good for helping to educate the uneducated. Well, that's highly unlikely, because there is more theories of pedagogy than you can begin to imagine. And if humans can't sort out with creativity and understanding, how on earth will this thing called wishy-washy AI begin to solve educating the uneducated when there are no theories to help us to do that? So this hyping is setting unreasonable expectations. It's actually destroying an enormous amount of wealth as people pour investment into startups which have absolutely no hope of succeeding because they haven't thought through where AI in its current form of just pattern finding with no understanding, they haven't thought through where success might be found in a reasonable way with pattern finding systems. So that's really where my contribution for the moment. Thank you.
You can't be reasonable nothing can be reasonable if the driver is, well, the effect of the actions are irrational exuberance and the false sense of urgency. Do it. That's the last train. If you don't catch it, you go bust. But if you catch it, all your problems are gonna be solved. That's it. You're all gonna be thriving. Yes, you can thrive. Yes, sometimes you have to not rush, never rush, but act in time, which means fast. But that's no reason to be exuberant without looking through the details. As Ryan Carrier said, look a little bit of the risk. Don't be risk averse, but look, understand the risks. And also, never rush. The best drivers are first to reach the destination safely without rushing. The drivers that rush usually crash and they never get to the destination. That's what I want to say. Thank you.
That's very right, sir. I'd like to ask Jeffrey, sir, your mic is working, then you can answer this.
Yeah, I think it's working now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good.
Perfectly fine.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about a specific example that I think is in agreement with what Bogdan and Richard just talked about. Think of radiology and Jeffrey Hinton saying that in 2016, that in 5 years, there will be no more radiologists because it will all be automated. In doing so, he basically said, there's only one way to do this. We're going to replace the radiologist. Any other work, you know, it's not just that we don't need radiologists. We don't need any other AI that does anything other than replaces the radiologist completely. So if you've got another way to do it, if you want to eliminate the easy ones, for example, so some of these images are easy to analyze and conclude that, okay, we don't need to worry about this person. This person is not, that has no chance of cancer or any other problem. So AI can do these kinds. It's not very hard. But when Jeffrey Hinton said that, and when the whole media jumped on it, everybody said, no, don't try anything simple. Don't try to solve any simple problem. We got to go for it all. So all you AI researchers, you want to do research comparing AI against doctors and show that AI is better. And I think that this type of example is just repeated over the whole world, where people with actually good ideas, improvements that could be made if we used AI or algorithms, as Richard said, right? Something simpler, just in algorithms. If we'd use those things, we'd be solving problems. We'd be so much further ahead right now than we are, because we would have solved some problems. We would have shown the world how these algorithms and AI can help. We would have encouraged other people to follow along. But instead, what we have are just disappointments. And so this hype is very dangerous. It pushes us away from solutions that can work and towards pie in the sky solutions that are going to take a very long time before we're ever able to make them work. Thank you.
Yeah, and I could just pop in here, Dieter, just to carry on what Jeffrey was saying. We're seeing this with all of the hype about autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. They're trying to solve everything to get to L4, L5, level 4, level 5. And it doesn't even work at level 2. I mean, I'm sure all of us have cars which have got some sort of aid to driving. And I've got one on mine which says, hey, there's a danger in front of you, about to crash, and bleep, 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 and red light. And it does it in stupid occasions. I mean, I've only had it happen once in 2 years when it's actually real. All the rest are completely spurious, because I know that I'm going there, and then I'm going there, and there's a car there, and I'm not going to hit it because I know it's there, and I'm going to drive around it. And, you know, all of this sort of stuff it's also killing people. Tesla have managed to kill about 7 or 8 of their own drivers so far, their customers, and because they called it full self-driving, and it's not even a level 2. And they're using it as though it's a level 3, which means I don't have to concentrate quite so much. And we know that's astoundingly dangerous. And it's called, this hype is incredibly dangerous, because we're not actually solving the useful problems.
Right. Thank you so much, sir. I'd like to ask Hooks and Ms. Savita, if you have any comments to add to it, then please go ahead.
So, I mean, on my part, I think it's beautifully summed up, you know, by the other panelists. And the main thing with the whole, I would say, you know, as far as the AI hype is concerned, is that there is a kind of a tilt. So one is essentially talking more about what AI can do, rather than the complexity of the technology. So how complex the technology is, what the response of the technology could be, is not delved into as much as what it can do. So a lot of it is actually, spoken in the air, or spoken about what it can potentially resolve. And that is the reason why it kind of holds back, and the kind of scalability of this technology is also not reached its full potential. You know, so, and I think that essentially is because of the whole marketing strategy. And like what Richard said, it kind of goes into the fact that a lot of the startups and the potential technology that they bring to the fore is played a lot more, especially in the marketing strategies, rather than what it could resolve, you know, and that focus, which is where Jeffrey came in, you know, that focus of resolving those issues, that exactly has not been, you know, being or addressed.
I'd like to come in, if that's possible. And I suppose my contribution, having agreed with everything that you, all of your observations are completely spot on. And I think one of the enabling factors for the hype is that this technology is being developed in basically an unregulated space, right? So you look at other forms of technology, and my background is I come from the world of broadcasting, media, television, radio, and then moving into the online space where I'm advising the UK government on what regulation we might stick around the online space. And you know, it sounds very old-fashioned, but when you look back at the history of regulation for broadcast, it was recognized way back in the 1920s that here was a new medium that was incredibly powerful. Suddenly, you could send sound and images into people's homes. And it was recognized from the day on that this was too important to be left in the hands of either the free market or the state. And in the UK, we came up with a sort of a system of a charter, a form of regulation that was in the public interest, so that broadcast, anyone who wanted to broadcast messages, speech, images, had to, I'm not suggesting it for here, but had to be licensed and had to meet certain standards. Okay. And what that led to, certainly in the UK, was a system within the broadcast community that already had codes of practice, standards, agreements around what was harmful, and that was the deal, okay? And then when the internet became a thing and became available to all, we know that that went on in a completely, you know, the whole premise of that was to move fast and break things, and the internet just went out, went out the traps, and became, you know, the way that we communicate in the space that we live our lives in. And it is only now that we are beginning to say, hang on, there are some potential downsides to this. No one is doing any form of risk analysis. No one is looking at harms, whether intended or unintended. And for me, the development and the sort of rise of AI is just basically a continuation of that, which is here is an iteration of a technology which promises amazing things, and which is, you know, the innovation around it and the development around it is being allowed to just go on unquestioned and unchallenged. And I think there are elements of lots of things in that. One, it's been allowed to happen in a completely unregulated space. There's exactly what Richard and Jeffrey have said. There's this sense that if you're not in the AI game as a company or as an investor, you're missing out. And there's not the, you know, the prior question, which is, does AI solve the problems we're trying to solve? A bit like in GDPR and data processing, you have to have a reason. You have to have a reason for why you're processing that data. Whereas with AI, it's a bit like every other sort of almost economic hype, going back to the, you know, Dutch tulip bulb hype of the 1600s and the art market hype, which is, oh, there's this thing and it's very exciting. I mean, we want to be a part of it, and its intrinsic value isn't necessarily related to anything, but we want to be a part of it. And you see that happening, which then feeds the hype. You know, investors want to get in on it. Everyone wants to put AI on their product title. Meanwhile, there's this whole industry, which goes from lawmakers to regulators to voluntary people, to people like us in this room that are going, hang on a second, you know, one, does it deliver everything you're saying? And two, who's looking at the risk? And for so long, we have allowed a sort of sense of the exceptionalism of everything that goes on in this space to make us lose our sense that actually it isn't exceptional. This is where we live our lives now. And we know from the offline world that we don't let things happen we don't create products or create spaces unless we've done some kind of a risk analysis, because we have a duty of care to the people that use them. And it seems to me that the wagons are beginning to circle around this space now, because people like us and others are saying, hang on a second, we don't even know what goes on in some of these systems, and yet you're all employing them. It's about time that we began to think about what standards, what regulation, what codes of practice, what risk assessments, what does transparency look like, what laws need to be in place. And I think that is beginning to be, you know, a sort of a parallel drumbeat in this world, and that's not going to go away. And I think that's really important.
Can I add something there? I think that governments have been a source of the hype. The consulting firms were the big hypers, but they convinced governments that they should pay the consulting firms huge amounts of money to do studies on the impact of AI. This occurred like at least 5 years ago. And the governments all bought into this idea that, oh my gosh, AI is going to be so big, everyone's going to go out of work. And in the UK, one of those big hypers was Daniel Susskind, whose book, A World Without Work, you know, you can just tell from the title. I mean, I've read the book, and he goes through, and the way he makes his forecast is that he looks at all these academic papers and then just concludes, okay, these academic papers are going to happen. Now, how many academic papers actually lead to products and services? I mean, if they actually, we've got 2 million published a year, and if you just look at IEEE and Nature and Science, you're talking about 10,000 articles a year. If even just a small fraction of those were resulting in new products and services, we would be so rich. The world would be so rich, but that's not happening. He also looked at these startups and said, oh, these startups are doing these things, and therefore AI is going to diffuse in this way. Well, most of these startups are losing money. But very few people have questioned his hype, and he's part of the UK government. And I think the UK government, I don't want to single out the UK government, because I think almost every government has bought into this, not just the UK government. The US is doing the same thing. So the governments it's a problem of there's a wholesale hype, and it's very hard to change that. It's very hard. We're very much a minority of voices. We're considered people who are, you know, hard to get along with because we disagree with people.
Well, the way forward is to sue them for sure. Must lawsuits. And that's that, because if until the regulation catches up, it seems that it is the only practical way. And I think I've told people 2 years ago, maybe more, watch out for the lawsuits. There you go. They're happening. Quite a few mass lawsuits in 2020 and 2021, and those are, you know, only talking about those that were out there in the mainstream media. There are definitely there are many, many others, not in the millions, but many, many others that involved, you know, hundreds and thousands of people, not millions, but hundreds and thousands of people. The media doesn't talk about, because then it will have to talk only about that. There are that many. So, and that will get worse, of course. And the root cause of all this is, well, the problem to solve is not defined, or is badly defined. And the reason it's not defined or badly defined is because of the hype. Because the hype does not define problems to solve. Usually, the hype in its extreme forms is finding or inventing problems to solve in a specific way. The problem may be real in the end, but it can be solved in very different ways, much simpler. But hey, those much simpler doesn't fit the hype, and therefore they're not going to be considered. Typical for automation. Automation is about solving repeated problems that don't change much over time. They may change, but not frequently and not much. And they're widespread, affect many people, not just a few here and there. And most of the time, they can be solved with simple means. You don't need machine learning for that and complex systems. But there are cases where AI is definitely a solver, for sure. But you have to define the problem to solve. And for that, you have to understand the stakeholders, the people involved. You have to understand the domain. You have to understand a lot of things. It's not going to be done on paper, you know. And that's where the root cause is. The problem to solve is not defined or is badly defined. And therefore, the solution does not really address the problem because it can't. And the hype is a major, the biggest player in all this. Because again, there's fake sense of urgency. Do it, no matter what. And also the irrational exuberance. Well, if you're gonna do it, it's gonna be paradise. And yeah, it can be paradise if you only look carefully at the problem to solve and define it well. Otherwise it won't be, because it can't.
Yeah, so with an industry,
After you, Jackie.
I was just going to say, I just read this week, there was an industry survey and something extraordinary, like 77% of companies surveyed were or expected to invest in some form of AI in the next year and then part of the business plan, without an idea as to why. They just knew that this was a thing that they need to signal that they were investing in. And they also did an analysis of where the decisions around what that means and what type of AI and what type of data to solve which problems was in within the company hierarchy. And it was way down. It wasn't with the board. It wasn't with the CEO. It wasn't with the risk committee. It was somewhere down with hired data scientists or engineers or analytics who were saying, well, we could buy that data set, or we could use that data set and we could, you know, employ it to do X. So these were just like completely random suggestions by employees way down the chain that this is something they needed to do and that they needed to signal to do. And I think the other issue is why this is worse than whether it's the fine art hype or the Dutch tulip bulb hype or something, is that actually, you know, those were speculative bubbles that burst and they didn't really affect anyone other than investors. But as if you've said, you know, said here, is the outputs of some of the use of this is really, really dangerous and really, really important, because we do not know, we cannot know, that's the whole point, as to why the systems, the use of the AI processes are coming out with the decisions that they do. So it's not like we can track back and say, well, when we, you know, made these different points of data interact, we knew what the system was. And again, one very recent example, I think researchers looked at four different natural language programs and set them a challenge of using rather large data sets. And the idea is that, you know, if you can afford really, really extensive data sets, then you're likely to meet more accuracy, you're likely to generate more accurate results. And they found that even the best of the four programs that they set on these data was only 50% accurate in coming out with answers about what people did, what they felt, and what they might do. And that the bigger the data set, the lower the accuracy, because obviously the biases and the inaccuracies in the original data set. And yet you've got people employing these to come out with, you know, real life decisions which will affect real life people.
Yeah, there's a couple of other points I'd like to relate to both what you've just been saying, Jackie. One is that we need to get the message across very, very strongly, not just to the CEOs and the CXOs, but right the way down through all the data scientists, is to get over this problem of we can, so we will, to ask the question differently. We can, but should we? And I think this is a really, really important one. Now that we're getting so many more sort of ideas about regulation, whether through GDPR and transparency of processing or the AIA, and many other countries are going to follow these approaches, it's going to become very, very important that corporate execs really start taking control of the we can, but should we question. The second point I was going to say was that with this incredible rush into doing things. We seem to have, across the industry, and I'm sure Bogdan and Jackie and Jeffrey, you've all seen this. We've forgotten the lessons from the last 40 years, and for me, the last 50 years about IT development. You actually look at the business issues and problems first. You have to understand those first to find out and to work out what sort of approaches are going to provide a business value-adding solution. And then you start looking at different technologies. And I don't know whether you, Jeffrey, or Bogdan, but I certainly had to go out and look for different software packages to solve certain problems. We didn't say, oh, we'll have this product. Now, I wonder what that's going to solve, what business problem we can use it with. We found out what we needed to do. We came up with some technical requirements that this solution required. And then we went to look for technical products that matched to a greater or lesser extent our list of requirements. Today, whether it's AI or blockchain, autonomous vehicles, well, quite a lot of emerging technologies. Oh, here's a lovely technology. You wonder what we should use it for. We must be able to use it for something, mustn't we? And then they shoehorn the problem into the technology. It's a bit like carpenters or joiners who only have a hammer, don't even have a saw. It's a bit difficult. And you get very botched results.
Well, there's two things. I like Dr. Jeffrey then to comment on what I'm saying. I'm just going to very briefly summarize them. One is the deeply unethical aspect. I'm just going to say about sustainability. Is this drive of deep learning neural networks based on masses of parameters? By the million and even by the billion, now we have 1.3, I think, billion, the latest from Microsoft parameters. Yeah. And what is not talked about, and it should be by design, how much energy these things consume. Mm-hmm. So if you design a solution that uses it, and it may be the right technology to use it, I'm not saying it won't be ever. There are cases where it can be useful for sure. But how much power consume your model in a typical day with all those millions of parameters and dips into masses of data? We're talking potentially petabytes of data, but certainly many terabytes at the very least, many, many times a day. Hundreds of thousands of times a day, potentially. And that's all computing. And also database dips are very expensive by comparison in sense of resource consumption. And, you know, it's like all these ledgers of cryptocurrency, they are very, very power hungry. So imagine that at a world scale, planetary scale. It's totally unsustainable. And, you know, we're talking about saving the planet, but we're doing exactly the opposite. So that is one aspect. The other aspect is bearing the science. So academics are forced into the role of essentially clerks. If they don't write masses of papers a year, they don't exist. I mean, they physically exist, but they're not going to get funding. Not going to get airtime, not going to get nothing. They're going to be swiped under the carpet. And if Marie Curie would be alive today, she would be an outcast. I'm not exaggerating. She would be an outcast.
I agree.
Because she's not going to write 100 papers or 50 papers a year that an academic in these days is required to write, no matter what. And she's not going to do that because what would she? That's not how she discovered radium, by writing papers. She discovered radium by building her own lab with Pierre Curie, by the way, finding it, you know, and having a day job and being irradiated, so exposing herself to risk without knowing, and Pierre Curie the same, and building the first mobile radiology shuttle, if you want, on the front line that saved many, many thousands of lives, and that the man, there's no time to write masses of academic papers, right? Because you do stuff. And the other thing is this masses, again, volume means low quantity. As a rule of thumb, too much volume, that is. I'm not saying volume, but too much volume. What is too much is not good, doesn't matter. And so the quality of these papers is subpar, because how can it be high when, I mean, you need time to write that paper. A lot of time, research is very time intense exercise. And so how the heck can you write dozens of papers a year unless they are superficial and just bad quality? You can't. Nobody can. And so science is buried and is taken apart and is basically ignored.
It's ignored. Yeah, I agree, Bogdan. We're giving people the wrong incentives and to publish too many papers and to not address real problems. And sustainability issue is a big issue. And a lot of this gets back to what Richard is saying, is that we used to focus on processes. There were business processes. We tried to improve those business processes. We used IT and various tools to improve those processes. Now we've got AI. Well, let's improve those processes. Let's improve the radiology process. We don't have to replace the doctor. We just have to improve the radiology process so that we make the radiologist more productive. So we make other workers more productive. We do these things and we will have successes. And AI will become even bigger than it, become much bigger than it is now. It'll just be very different.
And here is one big success I just want to briefly mention, because we talk about the negatives because, you know, that's not part of the hype, is it? The hype doesn't look at negatives at all, because why they should be? It's like they don't want to shoot themselves in the foot, the hypers. But here is a big success in the domain of the military and human rights. Spotting the use of banned ordnance, phosphorus and all. And discovering mass crimes against humanity. How it is done recently with great success is through using drones and computer vision and deep learning at the back, where they take high resolution scans on battlefields, traces of banned ordnance, which are otherwise are nearly impossible to detect. And it requires a lot of effort, nearly impossible. And by doing that, they discover where these ordnance and in what quantities pretty much were used. And therefore, that potentially constitutes a war crime. Definitely a crime, but potentially a war crime. So that has been done very well indeed. Guess what? It's not talked too much about it because, well, it's not hyperable, is it? It's not hyperable. And if it's not hyperable, it's not going to be talked about. Because, well, it doesn't fit the business model of the hype. It cannot close a feedback loop. So the business model that generates the hype cannot benefit. So if it doesn't benefit, then it's not going to look at it. Not going to be reported much. I mean, you're going to see those reports in specialist media and specialist resources, definitely on the UN, certain UN pages, and on the specialized military resources and so on, but that's about it. BBC not going to report it. Sky News not going to report it. CNBC, God help us. And everybody, all the major outlets not going to report it because, well, it doesn't feed the sponsors. You say, well, but the BBC state owned. Well, yeah, but the interest behind it to report, like we've seen the misinformation of the fake crisis of petrol station in the UK recently, where not even 1% were closed, but the media blown it out of all proportion, generated panic and essentially a national security risk. Would anyone go to jail? I don't know. But if I would want to do that, I would definitely go to jail because I'm a, you know, Joe Public always goes to jail. And so it doesn't fit the narrative, doesn't fit close a feedback loop, and they're not going to be talked about, even though it's tremendously important and proved in practical terms that save countless of lives. So it is life impacting. This hype is life impacting. Look, we are not making it up. We are not bashing AI here at all. we're just saying most of the time, majority of time, is not used in the right way, in a good way. And it can be used in the good way, and we have examples of that, but they are not talked about much.
Yeah, no, going back to what both you have said, Bojan, and also Jeffrey, if you think about some of the work that academics are doing, they too are not thinking we can but should we. If you think about the use of facial analysis to detect or to determine whether people are gay or lesbian, the gay ones, male, was around about 85% accurate, and the female about 65%, which is only slightly better than chance, actually, which is pointless. You know, it's a bit like, I forget who it was mentioning it a little bit earlier, about 50% accuracy. Well, if it's only 50% accuracy, you might as well flip a coin. There's no point in using that. And going back to face recognition that Jeffrey is mentioning, 95% sounds fantastic. It's actually, in practical terms, pretty much useless. Because, you know, that means 5 in every 100 attempts is going to fail. And we know that face recognition on, say, the British passport system is about 30% accurate, because most people I've talked to in the last few months have had to present their passports to the reader at least 3 times before it says, oh, hi, okay, go through. And that's only on a one-to-one match, a photo from there and your passport. So if it can only do it 30% accurate with your face high resolution about that distance, you know, it's a waste of time. Or if you're in a hotel, 5 in 100 presentations to your door, you're going to be rejected from getting into your own room. So we've got to be thinking more carefully about what these accuracy numbers actually mean in practical terms, not academic 50, 85, 95%, but reality. And it's like, Bolden, I'm sure you and I'm sure Jeffrey, in days that gone by, we were asked with our systems, what uptime do we need? Oh, we need 95% uptime. But that means 5 minutes every 2 hours, it's out of action.
We need 99... Sigma. Six sigma that people used to use. Sigma. That's the kind of accuracy we need.
Yeah.
Or else it isn't absolutely very useful.
And so, yeah. I think we've now, I've lost the track there, but that was one of the more important aspects that came out of it. Oh, and writing papers. Well, I'm very lucky, Jeffrey. I'm not one of your average academics. I'm allowed, don't have to write papers. My role is to do what I'm doing today, which is a great relief.
I think the other point, and Bogdan, you touched on it in terms of energy and the amount of resources it takes to mine these to create these many parameters and mine these data sources, is, you know, so much of this conversation comes back to data. Obviously the whole system is based on data, and I think, you know, going right back to the beginning, we need to land this in what data is. Data is personal information about you or I that we don't necessarily know that we've surrendered. People don't understand how much of their own personal data is out there. And when you see companies and startups and businesses who are saying, we want to use AI, we need to buy a data set or access a data, as if it's just a public thing and they're just going to, you know, go and buy something that is already accurate and available and so on. And these data sets, well, apart from the fact we know that they're not accurate, you know, they're predicated on data that you and I don't even necessarily know that we have surrendered or that exists out there. And, you know, we talk about giving people control back over their data, but the whole drive of the past decade has been that people don't, you know, it's all been about efficiency and frictionless transaction and getting to an answer really quickly. And people don't necessarily want to spend the time controlling their own data and thinking, what did I say yes to? Did I read the terms and conditions? Is there an alternative? Do I tick that box or do I say no to this one? You know, we're all part of it. We want to say, we just skip it. We say yes. And before we know it, you know, our data is out there and it's being scraped or used or, you know, misaligned and we don't know what for. And we need to have that conversation again, which is, you know, data is our identity. Data is the most important thing about us. What do we do about the data? We don't even know the amount of data that huge organizations own about us. And yet their business models are based on exploiting it. And how do we get that balance right between, I don't want to spend, I find it hard enough to run my life as is. I don't necessarily want to spend all my day thinking, my data, what do I do with? But we've got to have row back this conversation to think about data rights and what people are agreeing to. And there is no such thing as free data or public data that companies can use and scrape. And how do we do that? I mean, I know there's work with some local authorities and countries about data trusts and about putting data that is taken from public spaces, such as surveillance cameras and so on, into data trusts that can only be, you know, that are transparent and can be used. But we have to have that conversation, which is the source material for these systems is your and my data. And we don't know what's being used and we don't quite know what we've surrendered and given up. And how do we do that? How do we, you know, get back control of that? Because without that material, these systems can't be developed and can't exist, right?
And if I could just add there, you know, actually, I'd like to integrate, you know, what Richard and Bogdan has spoken about, especially with respect to businesses. You know, it's about meeting the reality with the expectations. So, you know, what we spoke about a little bit before, that the businesses essentially try to ride upon the whole AI scenario and try to bring it into the system. But when they work on their project, they forget the realities of privacy and security. And that is when, you know, the issue essentially knocks on them. And that is why a lot of the projects don't even take off. You know, three main reasons. One is, of course, the cost holds them back, because when they realize what the issues are to resolve, the costs are far greater. But most importantly, these privacy and security concerns are not taken into consideration when they say, oh, wow, this is an amazing technology. You know what Richard has said? It's not resolving anything. It's because something is great. You want to take it up. And then you start a project on it. But when you essentially go about analyzing what that project is about, one of the key concerns, as Jackie, you said, is about that privacy and security concern that has not been addressed in that whole project cycle. And a lot of it then means, you know, it gets taken back and they don't even take off those projects. It remains on paper. And that's where this whole AI hype also comes in, you know, because the expectations don't meet the realities. I think Jeffrey wanted to say something.
No, I'm okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say that something that Jackie and Savita were mentioning raises another interesting issue. Yes, a lot of this stuff is our data, but a lot of the problems with AI and analytics in general is because, as someone from IBM pointed out about 8 or 10 years ago, 80% of all the data that we're using is of uncertain veracity. We just don't know whether it's true or false. It's not that it's wrong. It's just that we don't know without major activity. And we know from practical experience over the last 20 years that something like 80% of all analytics project budgets is data cleansing. And if you don't have certain data, it's very, very difficult to actually do any analysis of it or make any proper management decisions unless you know the sensitivity of your decision-making to the differing levels of error within your data. And you know, you think about all this sort of stuff that Facebook and Google and Amazon do based around our likes and all this sort of tracking they do of us. Sometimes, or in the past, they've kept all of our data forever. Now some of the companies are thinking, actually, for things like likes, I'm only going to keep the last 2 weeks' worth of data because it's gone out of date. It's evaporated its meaning. And unless you start thinking incredibly carefully about this, and again, like with all of our personal data, actually, how much of it is actually of any importance in other than the PII sort of data, the identification type data, my likes, my dislikes, so what? And as long as I've got ad blockers and I've got cookie blockers and all sorts of other tracking blockers running in my browsers, do I, in many respects, care? No. I do care if insurance companies are going to start using my data against me, then I begin to get very, very upset.
Aditi has a few other huge topics to bring out, but just
before,
the job public, like us, like the majority of population, that's here is a problem. Is two-pronged problem. One, people don't own their own data. They don't. Not even the president of the United States owns his own data. That's a fact. The other one, equally big problem, is people don't understand their own data. That it's their most important asset. And with that, I'm going to shut up and let Aditi carry on because she has very interesting things to bring up.
Yes, we kind of used all our time for one question, but I'll ask my next question to Dr. Funk. So, sir, I'll just be very brief and ask a question. Some experts say that AI will have bigger impact than even Moore's law that showed us dynamic relationships that drove the tech industry to a massive scale that it is today. But ultimately, it is believed that the value which this AI will create would be even greater than all the previous information technologies that have been introduced in the past. In fact, some studies also suggest that AI will support doubling the growth of some of the leading economies and while increasing the labor productivity to 40%. My question to you would, sir, be that what is your opinion on that? Do we see a Moore's law impact when the use of AI technologies is overhyped and not even backed by any proper data?
Yeah, I don't see the rate of productivity growth growing. You know, there's a lot made of the increased growth, the faster growth in e-commerce and cloud computing and a few other old technologies. But there's absolutely no rapid growth in the adoption of new technology, whether it's AI, big data, algorithms, whether it's augmented reality, virtual reality, drone deliveries, or Internet of Things, or smart homes, or wearables, all of these technologies, very, very, very slow growth. And so, yes, we'll see e-commerce and cloud computing continue to grow, and they will continue to contribute to productivity growth, and robots too. I did my PhD dissertation on the economics of robots in 1984. And let me tell you, back in 1984, I thought that all the things we're doing now would have been occurred by 1990 or 1995. So every time I read these articles about it, there's some big deal, I think, wow, we thought that was going to happen 20, 25 years ago. So it's not going to be rapid. And part of it is because of the issues we're talking about now. We're doing it the wrong way. If we did it a better way, we could probably get faster rate. But it's also because AI just isn't as great as we think it is. And you know, some of you have brought this up with the amount of, with Bogdan mentioning how much data, right? How much energy it requires to do all this data. It's just it doesn't give us as much bang for the buck as we want it to do. And so, in general, I'm pretty pessimistic.
And you know what I've seen, the best productivity, the best efficiency, and the best value add, not value capture, but value creation, is in relatively small data. I mean, I wouldn't say small, but definitely not big. No, not millions of data points and parameters. No, hundreds, thousands, maybe tens of thousands. That's where the biggest value add is to be found and to be made. Not in the millions and billions of parameters. It's not there because simply it's not sustainable. Now it looks, oh, great. But when you tie it into the practical use case, as Dr. Jeffrey said, the gains are minimal, if any. Real gains, minimal, if any.
Dr. Sif and others, if you have anything to add to it, please go ahead.
No, I think we've covered quite a lot of areas today. I think that if people sit down, watch, and then think carefully about what we've all said from legal perspectives, from technology perspectives, and so on, I think we probably got quite a lot for people to take on board, particularly as it's going to require many people to change the direction of their thinking from, wow, I've got to have AI, to, I really need to think about it extremely carefully.
So here is another example that I discovered, that I like Jackie to comment on that, because she's coming from a journalism. She's a journalist, so she knows much better than me, of bad productivity. NLP badly implemented in the BBC. And here is an example. The fact that I discovered a few months ago, about 6 months ago, there's a BBC article on the front page. And it was about the economics and Mr. Rishi Sunak policies, which is a chancellor of the UK, number two in the state, in the government. And somewhere towards the end of the article, but not at the very end, we were saying, Mr. Rishi Sunak, the US Minister of Finance. Okay, so Mr. Rishi Sunak probably has to have US citizenship as well, because otherwise he can't be in the government there. He has also a ministerial post, number two in the US government as well. And people don't even know. Well, BBC may be onto something. And it was just there. I mean, if you read the article, it was there. I gave the link there. It was 1 day old at the time when I discovered it. I put it there. BBC took another day to correct it without saying nothing, not apologizing, not nothing, which is, again, I think it's probably, I mean, it may be unlawful, but definitely breaks the journalist's code of conduct. And why was that? Well, I'm pretty sure it was because of a bad natural language processing system. Yeah. All of about productivity, right? They just get to do away with the journalist. Yeah. I don't know what the editor-in-chief did. I have no idea, but clearly didn't do much for the editor. Again, this is a front-page article. And very important for business, it was about furlough and something else, like big policies, critical policies. Everybody was interested in that.
Yeah.
And so where is the productivity in the end? It's just ludicrous. But it's not because NLP is bad. But, you know, if it's implemented for the wrong case, if it's implemented without understanding what you need to do to make it run continuously at pace, with efficiency, you need to close that feedback loop in an efficient way, understand what the outcome is, and do stuff quickly and efficiently. And that requires certain skill sets, certain ways of working, and so on. If you don't do that, well, it's going to be up and then straight down. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And we've talked about this, and it's a bit like your example, Jeffrey, about the medical example, where the outcomes of, or the poor outcomes of misplaced use are really, really important. It doesn't matter if you're getting, you know, 1 out of 10 answers wrong. That's such a critical environment to be wrong. And I would say, obviously, of a lesser scale, but when we talk about journalism and information and people needing and deserving, you know, accurate and impartial information so that they can go about conducting their lives, which is the world I come from, then this is really important. And we know that these systems can lead to, you know, awful, awful amplification of disinformation and misinformation, which is really critical. And I would just, you know, end by saying, again, from the world that I come from, you know, I suppose the shorthand is that higher standards always lead to better outputs, that it is never a bad thing to have high standards at the beginning, because you always end up with better outputs. And for me, it's slightly alarming coming from a highly regulated space in which the regulation has helped create a really thriving economy, a creative economy in broadcast in the UK, but there's an expectation that it will meet certain standards and that you can rely on the outputs. And I think I think there is no going back from what we're seeing now, which is a recognition that we won't be able to put the genie back in the bottle, but that we need to start thinking about, you know, what duty of care that we have to people that these systems impact on, as Ryan said, and what systems of regulation and standards and codes of practice and risk assessment and legal systems need to be in place before the deployment, not afterwards. You know, you don't design a car, as we've said here, and put it on the road and then go, oh, sugar, we should have put seatbelts in or, you know, something like that. We don't do that. And we've allowed this sort of wonderment, this sense of wonderment about what the what artificial intelligence and so on can do to take over and you know, run away with itself. And then we're trying to row it back in. And that's got to be the wrong way around.
And it's also in that particular example, Bogdan and Jackie, illustrates one of the, to me, one of the worst areas of the hype about AI is that NLP in its present form cannot work in the way that humans do, because it is looking only at the patterns of bits and bytes without knowing its words, without understanding the concepts. It's not working how humans do. It's okay for trivial conversation, because, you know, we all know how to finish the sentences that we hear people saying in simple everyday context. I think that today's discussions, probably none of us could have finished any of the sentences that we've been using, because we're thinking in terms of ideas and concepts and meaning, and then finding the right words. We are not a stochastic parrot, as someone said these NLP systems are. And it doesn't matter whether you use GPT-3 with 17 billion parameters, or whether you look at the new GPT-4 that's being thought about with 1 or 2 or 3 trillion parameters, lots more electricity, they won't be any better, because they are only finding patterns in past conversations and writing of various standards without knowing what it means at all. There's no semantics or anything in it. And it's okay for trivia, but it's not going to be good for the sort of things that journalists are trying to do, period. And we should be not banning research into NLP, but the academics need to start thinking very fundamentally about completely different ways of doing the job and working on that, because we know that it's not working today, period.
You don't even have to look back and do pattern analysis and all. You can look at just a humble reader in the mainstream media today and see the masses of grammar errors, masses, maybe a bit unfair, but to the 95% point of Dr. Jeffrey, I mean, that's even better than 95% accuracy. It's about 98-99%. In many thousands of words, that 98% or 99% equates to ridiculous basic grammar errors. Not one in a page, but a few in a page, maybe 3 or 4 in a page. That's already too much, way too much. But hey, it's 98% accuracy, right? 98%, huge. No, it's bad. Ah, if you have 99.999%, yes, that is high accuracy. Or at least 99.9 at the very least. Consistently across all types of articles, which are very diverse, then yes. And it's not just, again, I single out the BBC, but it's not just the BBC. I've seen it on Al Jazeera, on TV, not once or twice, occasionally, but not once a quarter, much more than that. I've seen it on Sky News, again. I've seen it on other major media outlets too. And it's all started in the last 5 or so years. Before 5-6 years ago, I haven't seen a single grammar error, me personally. And then I start seeing them pretty rarely, but they start creeping in. And now are almost the name of the game, almost. I mean, I would be mesmerized to not see a grammar error in a week of reading the news. I would be mesmerized. It doesn't happen. It's there, like COVID.
so we kind of don't have too much time for the panel, but in the end, I would just like to ask one question to all of you, and then you can give the concluding remarks answering the question. Starting with Ms. Savita, my question would be, since the topic of diplomacy and governance is very important and it's well discussed today, my question would be, how, in your opinion, does this hype have an impact on diplomacy, governance, and even compliance issues?
I think the whole crux of AI hype is there in all the three. Actually, not so much in compliance, and like what Jackie essentially has been pushing, you know, regulation is so much at the back of this. But when you look at diplomacy and you look at, you know, the intergovernment relations, it's riding on this hype. Every particular government essentially feels this is the next geopolitical scene, whether it is, you know, China taking its, being a front runner with respect to the amount it is investing as far as AI is concerned, and US not being so far behind because it feels that it should be, you know, neck on neck, and both of them essentially taking on. And in all this, I think every government is trying to invest, saying that, you know, this is the next possible scene, and that essentially is affecting relations. And if anybody's not riding on this particular AI hype or is not realizing the potential of AI, they are saying that you essentially are not understanding the next scenario, the international scenario that would essentially pan out. So it's very important for the government to ride on this. So it's changed the entire way, actually, international relations is also run, because you're looking at this being one of the most important segments and one of the most critical elements in how, you know, regions are going to now starting to interact with each other. And there are a lot of, what do you call, different partnerships, whether it is the Global Partnership on International Alliances. All these essentially are riding on this AI hype. You know, they're not looking at the fact that it hasn't panned out. They're looking at that it will pan out, and therefore we need to rejig the entire international relations based upon this. So that's one aspect as far as this is concerned. But when you come to compliance, what is interesting, you know, when I looked at, you know, the different data that's out there, a lot of the general counsels don't feel the necessity to do this switch, don't feel the necessity that their areas require to be addressed through AI. There are certain segments within the, what do you call, legal field that is, of course, looking at AI and using it or integrating it within their system. But when it looks to compliances, there's nothing out there. None of the laws are addressing it as such. There's a lot of policies being made. There are regulations in EU, US that's come out. But if you were to look at from Indian standpoint, except for policy decisions, we're not seeing anything being addressed as far as compliance is concerned, unless you try and weave it in through data protection or privacy guidelines that are out there. So I feel this whole segment essentially addresses the issue of AI hype, you know, that you're doing a lot more in the areas that you shouldn't be addressing, and very lot less in the area you should, which is essentially regulation and compliance.
You can go next.
I'm sorry. One sentence from me. I only have one sentence to say.
The AI, yeah, okay, so please go ahead.
The AI hype has become so extreme that is life impacting, wrecking the planet, and burying science.
Let's focus on a real process and how we can improve it through algorithms, various kinds of AI, IT and AI.
Yeah, I think on the compliance side, we need to be thinking much more about the transparency requirements, the understanding of these black boxes, so that we can actually understand how the decisions that black boxes are making are being made. That's an area I think we need to be thinking about carefully.
I would just say, you know, tech, all emerging tech should be deployed for the advancement of humanity and not for simply for profiteering, and that we should not buy in to the exceptionalism around some of this stuff, but we should rather apply the same expectations of standards, risk assessment, transparency, and so on to this world as we do to every other system and process in the offline world.
Well, with this, we come to an end of this session, of this panel. Thank you very much to all the panelists for this amazing discussion we had today. And with the hope that others would have gained immensely through this discussion, and I say that because personally I feel that I have added a lot to my knowledge after listening to all of you. And in the end, I just like to say that it wasn't years ago when people were amazed with the internet, and today it has become an integral part of our daily life. And so is AI, from communication to banking. AI has been used every day in our lives, and the day is not very far when AI will become as commonplace in our life as we regularly browse the web for anything. And the time that we may look back and wonder why we took so much time not to see beyond this hype and understand the real potential problem and revolution of technology. So on behalf of ISIL, we are grateful to all the panelists here and Mr. Rankarrier, who shared their time from their busy schedule and participated in this discussion. Therefore, on behalf of ISIL, I thank you all from the bottom of my heart. To the viewers, I would like to say that stay tuned to this channel, because another discussion is scheduled in a few minutes, and have a discussion on deciphering explainable AI for the Pacific, which would be moderated by Madhukar Bhattacharya. Thank you so much for joining for this discussion. We can now kind of end.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, and bye.